All right, so let's get started. I have a my cheat sheet that I will put in the chat here that if it's helpful for you, then great. I can also send it by WhatsApp later. Hopefully that'll work for you. But I could send it, and really it's just just a short one sentence on each idea just to help you prompt you, remind you later if you want to refer back to it. Okay, so let's get started. So I have 10 ideas here that I want to try and get through. Some of them are multiple ideas within one, just I bundled them together because they went together nicely. So the first idea I'd like to start with is questions at the Seder. And this is an idea I saw from Rav Pesach Kron's new Haggadah that I got last year at the Magid Seder. And he quotes from Rabbi Yonasan Shippel, who's a rabbi on the Upper West Side in Manhattan, also a Rebbe at Yeshiva University. And he asks, why is there such a stress on asking questions the night of the Seder? We do so many things. We have the Manishtana, the four sons asking the questions. We do so many things to try and encourage kids to ask questions with the dipping and the moving the table and picking up the cups and the matzahs and pointing. And I remember a Rebbe of mine, I think it was a Rebbe of mine, who once said that he put shoes on so that the kids would ask questions. Why are you putting your sneakers on the night of the Seder? He said, well, because tonight we're going to be running out of Mitzrayim, so we have to be ready to run with our sneakers on, right? Doing all kinds of things. So why do we do this? Why is there such a stress on us asking questions? So Rav Yonasan Shippel says, you know why? Because a slave can't ask questions, right? The master says, paint this wall over here. The slave says, okay, what color do you want? Right? The master says, make me pizza. The slave says, okay, what do you want as toppings? But he Ben Chorin, if he was a Ben Chorin, you can ask questions. Why this wall? Maybe we should do the other wall. That we haven't painted that wall in 5 years. That one has cracks all over it. Oh, you're right. Why pizza? The doctor said you should be watching your weight. You should eat a quinoa chicken salad. Oh, you're right. You're right. Thank you. That's what we do Seder night with so many questions. And the central theme of encouraging questions is to show that we're free. And I'd like to share a story I saw from Rav Ephraim Goldberg, rabbi in Boca Raton, a few months ago. He shared a story about Isidore Isaac Rabi, Izzy Rabi. He was a physicist and a Nobel Prize winner, recognized for his discovery of MRI, I believe, nuclear magnetic resonance. And he was born in a Jewish family in Hungary, came to the U.S. as a young child. And in 1988, shortly after he passed away, there was an article in the New York Times, a letter that he'd written, and it discussed there, asking him, why did you become a scientist? Most kids coming from Brooklyn, like his friends, maybe doctors, lawyers, right? The Jewish mother is very proud of those sons that go on to become doctors and lawyers, right? That's the joke. So why scientist? Maybe even a businessman? No, scientist. So Izzy answered, my mother made me a scientist without even intending to. Every other Jewish mother in Brooklyn would ask her child after school, so did you learn anything today? What'd you learn today? But not my mother. He said, my mother asked me a different question. Izzy, did you ask a good question today? Did you ask a good question today? That's the difference. Asking questions is what made me a scientist, made me curious, made me inquisitive, and turned me into a scientist. So the lesson here, I have four lessons from this about asking questions, things that we could do practically and thinking about it, the Seder and really beyond the rest of the year. So first of all, the Seder night. What can we do to encourage our kids to ask questions at the Seder? Whether it's doing something more experientially, like we've spoken about in the past years about making moments at the Seder, and you can refer back to some of those ideas that I shared there. Whether it be like I just mentioned before about my Rebbe, or I forget who it was that told me they put sneakers on the night of the Seder to get the kids to ask questions. So that's at the Seder night. But even beyond that, encouraging our kids to ask questions the rest of the year, on a Stam night, on a Stam Shabbos, as we're sitting around the table, questions about each other's week, what happened in school, Ima and Abba, what interesting happened at work this week? Or even questions they may have in Judaism, in Yahdut, in Emunah, and they're not thinking of the time or their space to to ask these questions in school. So long, of course, so long as it's done sincerely and not cynically, like the Russia and the Pesach Seder, his question is cynical. But it's important to welcome those questions year round. Third, encouraging kids to ask parents and grandparents about their life, about growing up. What was it like when you went to school? What was your Seder like? Do you remember when Israel became Medina Israel? As Rabbi Jonathan Sacks of blessed memory recently, a few months ago, passed away, he writes, we underestimate how much our children want to hear from us the stories that give sense and purpose to our lives and will one day give them strength. Right? Our past is probably much more interesting to our children than we think it is. We think, why would it be so interesting? It's what happened to me years ago. Why would they think it's interesting? And the Seder night shouldn't be the only opportunity that we take to share our family narrative. But on a regular Erev Shabbos, to call and talk to parents, grandparents, uncles, friends, cousins, whoever, people that you may be close to, older people from past generations, and find out about their story, that's asking questions year round. And finally, we can be Shoel, we can ask from Hashem. Rav Yechiel Spiro in his Haggadah, Touched by Our Story, writes that before the Manishtana, many Haggadahs have written, V'kan HaBen Shoel. Here the son should ask. And he writes that many great tzaddikim read something deeper into these words. It's not just referring to young children asking the Manishtana, but it's for all of us. The proverbial son, Banim Atem LaHashem Elokeichem, that we are all sons to our father, to Hashem. And this is a chance for us to ask for our needs. It's a very auspicious time. Rabbi Spiro concludes that the Satmar Rav used to give those in need special brachos at this time at the Seder. And many of those brachos were fulfilled. So this is why Rav Yonason Shippel said we should ask questions Seder night to show that we are no longer slaves. And we saw the story of the mother who asked Izzy what question he asked every day, which led to the discovery of MRI, which some of the people on this call may have even benefited from. And the four lessons that we suggested for asking questions at the Seder. So that's part one. Don't worry, not all of them are this long. Okay, number two. Four expressions of freedom. The Arba Lashonos of Geula. This is an idea from Rabbi Dr. Norman Lam Zatzal, who was Nifter about a year ago. So we know the four cups that we have at the Seder, based on the Yerushalmi, are representative or corresponding, according to the Yerushalmi there, corresponding to the Arba Lashonos of Geula, the four expressions of redemption, of freedom. V'hotzeitzi, v'itzalti, v'ga'alti, v'lakachti. And Rabbi Lam notes that these four expressions, right, I will take you out, I'll save you, I will redeem you, and I will take you, they all have a common denominator. Aside from all being synonyms of being redeemed, says that they're all expressions of change or conflict without a suggested change in course of action. Meaning, in order for conflict to be meaningful, it has to come with a suggestion for improvement on how to change. It's not enough just to say, oh, this is no good. Oh, we have to change. We can't have to get rid of the government. The government's terrible. We have to, just saying things are bad is not helpful if you don't propose a solution. Don't propose change. And this, says Rabbi Lam, is where the fifth expression of Geula, Vehevesi, comes in. Not just to replace the current reality, overthrow the Egyptian regime, right? I'm going to take you out. I'm going to redeem you. I'm going to save you. But to fill the void with positive replacement, that I will bring you to the promised land. I'm not just going to take you out, but I'm going to bring you to the promised land, to Israel. And which cup does that correspond to, Vevesi? That's the cup of Eliyahu, the fifth cup, which comes at the end, towards the end of the Seder. What do we say right after the Koshel Eliyahu? We get up, we stand up, we sing L'shana Haba Birushalayim, right? That's our modern day call to action. We're not just confronting the conflict, saying, oh, there's anti-Semitism. Oh, we were slaves in Egypt. Oh, there's the democracy is being threatened in the world. But rather, vehevesi, let's make a plan and let's change the current reality by coming home. That's my shout out. Jerry, there's my shout out for making Aliyah. Okay, number three. Hold on 1 second. Akiva can just answer this.
Come on out. I was taking notes during that one.
Okay. Number three, where is Rosh Hashanah at the Seder? Okay. This is from the Haggadah Touched by Our Seder by Rabbi Yechiel Spiro. So let me ask you, throw it out to the crowd here. Where in the Seder might we see Rosh Hashanah? Might have allusions to Rosh Hashanah or Seder night? Any suggestions?
It says somewhere that Pesach is the Rosh Hashanah Be'emunah, but I don't remember where.
Very good, very good. That's one of the things I have here. I could the others say it, but I saw in the Nesiva Shalom in Slumner.
Oh, that's where it is.
Rabbi,
that's where
it is. He refers multiple times to Pesach night as the Rosh Hashanah Be'emunah. Very good, Micah. Okay. Another cutesy one before we get to the real one that my wife Ilana actually pointed out. Is that on Rosh Hashanah night, we dip the karpas into the salt water and the maror into charoses, which perhaps parallels the dipping of the apple into the honey. But another possibility is based on the following cute incident. This is again is from the Touched by Our Seder Haggadah. Once when he was 3 years old, the Kolashitzer Rebbe saw his grandfather, the Shinover Rebbe, walk out of his room wearing his kittel and head to the Beis Medrash to blow shofar. And he pointed to him and he said, oh, look, mama, the Zaidi's going to eat karpas. So, you know, superficially, it seemed kind of cute and innocent mistake that the three-year-old made. Maybe it was because this grandfather was wearing a kittel and he associated the kittel with the Seder night. But when the Shinover Rebbe heard what his grandson had said, he noted, actually, we eat karpas and blow shofar for the same reason. We eat karpas and blow shofar for the same reason. Rav Moshe Wolfson, who's a big Baal Mashava in Brooklyn, explains in his Haggadah that the whole reason for dipping karpas in the salt water is to get kids interested and engaged, not only to ask questions, like we noted before, but to keep them awake. Where you do strange things at the Seder, then they're engaged. They're like, wait, what's going on in here? Oh, very good, Shlomo. He said both Pesach and Rosh Hashanah wear kittel. Very good, very good. Okay, so the Rav Moshe Wolfson said, this is why we blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah also. Uri Yesheni Mishinaschem, right? Like the Rambam writes, to wake up people from spiritual slumber. And Rav Moshe Wolfson says, that's the exact same idea with the strange statement by the Rasha. By the Russia, we say hake eshinav. It's strange. It literally hit his teeth. It seems kind of violent. Definitely wouldn't pass in 2021 to say hake eshinav, meaning to hit his teeth literally. But Rav Wolfson says, read it as not as shinav, but at hit his shena, hit his sleep, wake him up spiritually. So if you remove the shin, right, you have Russia, you remove the shin, the shena from Russia, what are you left with? Not ra, switch it around, air, he's awake. You knock the Russia, meaning you wake him up, you wake him up from his slumber, and then he is awake. He's no longer the Russia. You take the shin, the Shana out from him, the sleep, the slumber, the tiredness away from him, and he's now awake. And that's what it means, Pesach night, that we are dipping karpas to keep the kids awake, to engage them, not only to ask questions, but to keep them awake. Just like Rosh Hashanah, the shofar spiritually wakes us up, so too Leil HaSeder. It's also a time of waking up spiritually, not just physically, but spiritually too. We'll come back to staying awake at the Seder a little bit. Okay. Number four, Haggadah. We spend several hours, some places, some people, some starim, perhaps spend almost the whole night going through the Haggadah. We call it Haggadah. Okay, why is it called Haggadah? And this is from the Four Sons Haggadah from Rabbi Alan Schwartz, who's also a rabbi on the Upper West Side and a Rebbe at Yeshiva University, who I was zocha to learn Tanakh with for several years, and I very much enjoyed his shirim. So he asks, or he points out there, that there's four. Oh, I'm sorry, hold on. Okay, so we said, why do we call it Haggadah, right? Because it says in the Psukim, V'yigata levincha b'yom ha'hulei mor. Okay, fine, you should tell your son on that day, meaning Pesach, saying, the night of Pesach, you tell him about the story of Yetziyat Mitzrayim. But why does the Torah use this word, v'yigata, lehagid? Why not lesaper, or lemor, or ledaber? Why not any of those shorashim, of those words for speaking? So Rabbi Alan Schwartz points out four different definitions of the shoresh of lehagid, vayaged, based on Medrash and the Gemara and Shabbos. And he says that each of these different definitions of vayaged applies as a suggested, nuanced approach in speaking with and telling over the story to each of the four sons. So number one, he says, is precision. By Kabbalah HaTorah, it says, Vatagei libnei Yisrael, relate it over to the Bnei Yisrael, which the Medrash says means, Hagei lahem vatidak deik imahem, relate it to them and be precise with them. So which son do you think this refers to? This is the Chacham, right? The Chacham. What does the Chacham say? He's the one that wants to know about all the laws. Ma ha'edus v'achukim. So he deserves a detailed and precise answer. Okay, so that's number one. By Kabbalah HaTorah, it also says, Vayagid Moshe's Divrei Ha'am El Hashem, which the Gemara and Shabbos gives three definitions for. Nuanced, but they're still different. The first of the three is that he should speak like sinews, you know, like sinews, tendons, like the Gidim. Moshe spoke to Bnei Israel as tough as sinews. Now, this is the approach of the Rasha, right? That the Rasha is being cynical, so you need a more direct approach, a tougher response to the Rasha. But Rabbi Schwartz also points out that the Gidim, the sinews, are connected to the tendons. These are what strengthen the limbs in our body. And in many ways, the Rasha is the weakest link in the family. And therefore, he needs to be shown extra care and concern in order to reach him and strengthen him, just like the sinew strengthens the other limbs. So actually, this is the exact opposite of tough, of being tough and giving him a tough approach, you know, tough like sinews. But it's actually saying that you have to be very sensitive to him and approach him almost like with kid gloves to make sure that we don't lose him. So that's what it means, like sinews. And the third one is appeasement. Moshe spoke in a way that appeased the minds of man. Dvarim shmeshivin da'ato shel Adam. And this is the approach to the Tam, the simple and pure child. Because the Tam is like a blank page. You have to make sure that this child is ready to absorb the lessons of the Torah. And so we speak to him in an appeasing way. And finally, we have the idea of lahagid vayaged as drawing in. Moshe spoke in a way that would draw their hearts, much like Agadata does. Dvarim shemoshchin libo shel Adam ke'agada. Right? It's like stories. And this is the Eino Yodea Lishol. We have to excite him. He doesn't even know how to ask a question. So we have to tell him a good story, bring him in. And he won't be engaged unless we draw him in with stories, with things that are exciting. So those are the four approaches of Haggadah, four different definitions and approaches for four different sons. But I'd like to suggest a fifth definition of Haggadah, and this is based on Rav Soloveitchik, something Rav Soloveitchik writes, that means thank you. Haggadah means thank you. Because Rav Soloveitchik asks, Kiva, you know about this one. Rav Soloveitchik asks that at the start of Magid, the main part of Magid, really, not the very beginning, but the main part of Magid, we're telling over the story of Yetziyat Mitzrayim. And how does it start? I would think we're going to start with the opening psukim of Yitzias Mitzrayim. Let's talk about Yitzias Mitzrayim. But what does it say? Arami Yoved Avi. Seulmad Mabi Kesh Lavan. My father was an Armenian, perhaps referring to Lavan. And psukim from the Bikurim. And about Lavan, this is it. What is this? It's Yes Mitzrayim. Where's the Egyptians? Where's the slavery? Where's the Vaymaru Eschayehem? These are the psukim that should be mentioned at the beginning of the story. Rav Soloveitchik explains that Haggadah means not only to tell a story, but also to give thanks and praise to Hashem, because in Kisava, where it talks about the Bikurim, when it says Arami Yoved Avi there. So when you bring the Bikurim, it says in the Psukim, Higadati Hayom LaShem Elokecha, that I told on this day to Hashem. And there the Targum Yerushalmi translates that as Shevach, as thanks, giving thanks to Hashem. And this is why the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim starts with these Psukim, even though they don't seem to be connected to Yetzias Mitzrayim. Because Leil HaSeder is not only about Haggadah, about telling the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim from our history, from the past, but it's also to thank Hashem for all the good he's done for us in the past and continues to do for us in our lives. So last year, now a little bit of a practical application here. Last year, I suggested making a Dayenu for parents, grandparents, or other close friends or family, of all the things that they do for you and that they share with you and give to you, and put that together and send it to them or in advance of the Seder. Or if you're Zocher to do so this year too, to give it to them at the Seder, read it for them. But I'd like to add another idea. I recently heard a shiur by a friend of mine, a colleague of mine, Rabbi Dr. Mordechai Schiffman, who is a rabbi in Brooklyn. He teaches at Azrieli at Yeshiva University. He's also a psychologist. And he gave a shiur on gratitude in the Haggadah. And I thank him for giving me a shout out in his shiur, about an article I wrote a few years ago on making moments at the Seder. So I will reciprocate now and give him a shout out. He suggested doing a gratitude visit. Gratitude visit. This is an idea based on Martin Seligman, who's the father of positive psychology. He says, think of somebody from your past who changed your life for the better, who you never properly thanked, that you know that you're able to still go and meet them face to face next week, a week or two. And you should write a letter of gratitude to this person and deliver it to them in person and read it to them. And be very, very specific about what they did and how it changed you, impacted your life. Tell them what you're doing now and why you always think of them and will always remember what they did for you. Because doing this will not only create an emotion of gratitude, like the Dayenu does for us at the Haggadah, and like my original suggestion of having a Dayenu for your family members, but this creates a memorable moment of connection. And Rabbi Schiffman suggests that not only that, taking this a step further, that the Seder night itself is our own personal gratitude visit to Hashem. This is our reading the gratitude letter of the Haggadah and Hallel and thanking Hashem for everything they did, telling him how it impacted our lives. But even taking it a step further than that, Rabbi Schiffman suggests writing down your own personalized gratitude visit letter to Hashem and reading it at the Seder. Or writing a gratitude letter to somebody else that's going to be at your Seder and reading it to them there at the Seder. So that's the fifth definition of Haggadah. Not only speaking to the four sons, four different ways of speaking to them, but giving thanks on the Seder night. Okay, we're up to five. I see I'm running out of time. Okay. Maisib Reb Lazar, Rabbi Twersky's Haggadah. Rabbi Twersky passed away a few months ago, so I want to share two ideas from him tonight. We'll see if we get to the second one. He says, Maisib Reb Lazar, we have the story with the five Chachami, Maisib Reb Lazar, Rabbi Shua, Reb Lazar, Ben Zari, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon. And they were sitting in the day Brach, and they were having the Seder and telling the story of Yitzhiya Mitzrayim all night long until the Tamim came and said, oh, Rabbi Seinu, the morning has come, it's time for Shema. And the question is, why are we told about this story of the five Tamim Chachamim? Is it just because they were talking about Yitzhiya Mitzrayim all night and it's Pesach night? But why, so to speak, canonize this and put it into the Haggadah text for all eternity? What's so important about it? Is there perhaps a deeper message that we can learn from that? And Rabbi Twersky explains, remember, Rabbi Twersky is one of the greatest psychologists, Jewish psychologists, if not the last generation of our time, of all time, weaving together Torah and psychology. And he points out that Erev Pesach is a very, very busy time. And you're very tired. You've been cleaning for a week. And then you go and you have a big glass of wine on a half-empty stomach. And then you're reading through Magid and it's getting late. It can very easily bring drowsiness on during Magid. And Rabbi Twersky wants to suggest that fatigue, as much as it is, I'm just going to read his sentence. Fatigue is as much a psychological phenomenon as it is a physiological condition. Meaning, to remain awake all night after all of that tiredness by merely discussing the miracles of Mitzrayim indicates how something psychologically stimulating can overcome this physiological nature of being tired. I mean, just think to the time that maybe you were dead tired and you went to a really energetic Shweki concert. Or you went to a really funny comedian, stand-up comedian. So even though you're really tired, it's engaging. It's entertaining. And so it keeps you awake. It overcomes that psychological stimulation, overcomes your physiological tiredness. And so if something is engaging and stimulating, that'll keep you awake. And that's what Rabbi Twersky says. This paragraph teaches us that the rabbis, by speaking about the miracles, they were so engaged in the miracles that even though they were so tired, it was all night long, it didn't faze them. They didn't even know it was morning because they were so engaged. They were able to overcome their physiological tiredness. And so it's just a message to us that we should do things for the kids or even adults. We're all kids at heart. Even adults, to make the Seder more engaging. Oh, gosh, I'm running out of time here. Is Ravelli? Oh, Ravelli's on. Okay. All right. Makas Arba, the plague of locusts. So it is number six. In the Torah, by this plague, Paro says something very strange. This is the only plague in the Torah. What, Akiva? Very good. Akiva, my son Akiva here, said, this is the only plague where it refers to, where Paro says, remove this rock, v'yaser me'alai, rock es hamaves hazeh. This is the only one of the plagues where Paro refers to it as a death plague. And the question is, why is this the only one? What about any of the others that came before that? The frogs or the boils or the aro, people were getting eaten up by wild animals. That's not death, but only here by the arbe, by these locusts. I mean, you know, locusts don't seem like death eaters, but what's going on? Why is that? Why is he referred to them as death?
So it caused the lockdown.
You're close, Jerry. You're very close to the second idea here on this. Okay, so quickly, I don't have time to go into this so detailed, but the Medrash HaGadol, it's fascinating Medrash HaGadol, and I thank Rabbi Dov Lerner for pointing these out to me. The Medrash HaGadol describes the Arba not as some minuscule little locust, but he says that the locusts were like these scary, deadly, mutant beasts with toxic saliva. The Medrash says raket hamaves, and it reads it homiletically roke. Roke is saliva, spit, and that it was like deadly saliva, toxic. And it describes these locusts as having teeth of iron and horns like oxes and claws like lions, etc., etc. And so now you can understand why Paro might refer to them as get rid of this death, because they really were very scary. But even more than that, Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch writes, and this is getting to what you said, Jerry, in the complete destruction of every vestige of the Egyptian agricultural riches, Paro finally realizes the complete downfall of Egypt. If the locusts remain in Egypt and deposit their larvae in the land, all future harvests are doomed. And essentially what Rav Hirsch is saying is that it's not referring to physical death, but an economic death. And this is like the final nail in the economic coffin of the Egyptians, that Paro sees not just as a temporary assault of the locusts coming and eating what's there, but a lasting damage. And that's why he calls it death, and that's why he's so desperate. And that does relate to what you said, Jerry, because, you know, while the loss of life over the last year from Corona was really unfathomable, with millions who passed away, and even one person that dies is a whole world lost, kal vachomer millions. But the impact the pandemic had on the economy is also deadly and destructive. And the over a million people in Israel alone that were on unemployment, business owners with stores closed and restaurants closed. And just this morning, I was in a store, the passport picture person, he said that he just opened a week ago for the first time in a year. And a lot of his equipment had dust in it and got ruined, and he had to buy new equipment. It's terrible. It as much as the death is death, and that's what Paro is referring to here. This not only these terrible deathly locusts based on the Medrash, but even the economic death. Okay, I have 4 minutes left. Let's see here. What should I do? All right, we're gonna have to skip some of these ideas, unfortunately. Okay, Bechol Dor Vador. We say that in every generation, that a person, you have to view yourself as if you went out of Mitzrayim. So I had a story there. Maybe I'll share it together with the cheat sheet to the WhatsApp groups, and you can read it there. But the second idea on this, again from Rabbi Twersky, I just want to remember him, so share another idea from him. I remember hearing this idea from Rabbi Hanan Balk, who's the Rav of the Shul, where I grew up in Cincinnati. And he shared this like 25 years ago in the Shabbos Agado Drasha. And it always stuck with me. He said, Rabbi Twersky says, on this obligation to actively imagine the experience of Mishibud Legula, it seems so difficult because we were never slaves. How many of us from Western culture were slaves, have that slave mentality or understanding of what it means to be a slave? But he says, it's not as difficult as it may seem. We vividly dream, and our minds can create three-dimensional color experiences, and we see ourselves participating in these scenes. So if we're familiar with the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim and the details, we can imagine ourselves, take a minute before saying this, or at some point in the Seder, close your eyes. Have everybody at the Seder close their eyes. And you could do one of those meditations like they do, you know, with your eyes closed and talking in a soothing voice to bring you to a place where you feel calm and safe. And talk about how the Jews were imagine being in the straw pits, clearing the straw, mixing it with the mud, baking it into the bricks in the tropical sun. You can even read this paragraph if you want. I could share this too. One should hear the scolding Egyptian taskmasters and feel the lashes of the whips on their backs. One should visualize the plagues and panic of the Egyptians. Then one should see oneself as part of the throng leaving Egypt, following Moshe into the barren desert. Finally, one should be standing at the edge of the Red Sea and hear the thunder of Paro's chariots approaching. Feel the terror of being trapped, and then see the glory of God as the waters of the Red Sea divide. So perhaps this year we can now not merely read the statement, Bechol Dor Vador, but even take a moment for everybody to close their eyes, like I suggested, and actively imagine ourselves there in Yetziat Mitzrayim. Okay, since I'm basically out of time, and I'm sorry, Ravelli, I'm going to take probably another 4 minutes for this, but we have to end with a story and end on an upbeat note. So we will end with number 10, Lashana Abba, and the Nirtza Piyutim. And as we end the Seder and go to Lashana Abba and Nirtza, which is really one of my favorite parts of the Seder, if not my favorite part, where everybody's singing and everybody after four cups of wine is very happy, if they're not sleeping. And Rabbi Beryl Wine asks, why were these Piyutim specifically chosen to end the Seder? How'd they make the cut? And Rabbi Wine says that the theme of all these Piyutim, if you look throughout, and runs throughout all of them, is their upbeat nature and optimism looking ahead to the future. Lishana Haba, right? The rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. These are all things looking ahead to the future. We're not dwelling on the past. Oh, we were slaves. Oh, woe is to us. Oh, we want reparations for being slaves in Egypt. Oh, the past. We're not dwelling on the past. We've moved past that. We're not even dwelling on where we may currently be. We're focused on the future and ending with optimism and hope. So on that note, let me end with a story of optimism and hope. Simon Wiesenthal, the famous Nazi hunter, was once speaking at a conference of European rabbis, and this is when he's already 91 years old, and they gave him an award, and he was very moved. So he shared the following story with them. He was in Mauthausen, the camp, shortly after liberation. Rabbi Eliezer Silver came. He was the head of Agudat Rabbanim. He was also a Cincinnati connection. He was a rabbi in Cincinnati for many, many years. Very helpful in trying to save people during the Holocaust and even after. So he came to the camp to offer aid and comfort to the survivors. And Rabbi Silver organized a davening. And he invited Wiesenthal to join the other survivors at the prayer. And Wiesenthal declined. And he said, you know, in the camp, I saw there was a religious Jew. And somehow he smuggled in a sitter into the camp. I was very, very, I admired him for his courage to smuggle it in. They found out it was instant death. He risked his life to bring that sitter into this camp. But the next day, I realized to my horror that this man was renting out his sitter to people in exchange for food. People were giving him their last morsel of food. They barely had any food to begin with. And they were giving it to him just for a few minutes with the precious sitter to be able to daven from the sitter words that they couldn't remember, that they lost and were yearning for so much. And this man, who is so thin and emaciated to begin with, you know, was soon eating so much food, it overwhelmed his system and he died from that because his system couldn't handle it. And Wiesenthal continued and said, if this is how religious Jews behave, I want nothing to do with this prayer book, with the sitter, with davening, so I'm not going to come. And as Wiesenthal turned to walk away, Rabbi Silver put his hand on his shoulder and said to him, you silly man, why do you look at the Jew who used his sitter to take food out of starving people's mouths? Why don't you look at the many Jews who were willing to give their last piece of bread in order to be able to use the sitter? That's faith. That's the true power of the sitter, said Rabbi Silver. And then Rabbi Silver gave him a big hug. And Wiesenthal concluded his story to this group of Rabbanim. I went to the prayer service the next day. Wiesenthal realized that it's all a matter of perspective. Rather than focusing on the negative, Rabbi Silver helped him see those who are willing to sacrifice. That's what we do at Nirtza. We may have been slaves, and we may still be without the Beis HaMikdash, but we too have faith, focusing on the positives and maintaining a positive outlook of hope that already Lishana Hazo, this year, this week, next week, tomorrow, this Pesach, that we'll be able to join together with our family and friends as we bring the Karban Pesach in Yerushalayim, Be'ezrat Hashem. Wishing you all a Chag Kasher V'Sameach, and I'll send out the cheat sheet with those two things I mentioned as well later. Thank you all for joining. Now we have, thank you to Rav Elio Zarowski. Thank you.